From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. That was the sound of one of many protests that sprang up around New York City Wednesday after word came out that a grand jury hearing the case of the homicide of Eric Garner had returned no indictment. Thousands gathered and marched across the city from Times Square to Rockefeller Center, shutting down the Brooklyn Bridge and filling Grand Central Terminal, where protesters chanted Eric Garner's last words.
I can't breathe! I can't breathe!
Last July, Garner was taken down by six New York City police officers and held in a chokehold. A videotape of the incident made by a witness recorded him clearly and repeatedly telling police he couldn't breathe.
I can't breathe! I can't breathe! I can't breathe! I can't breathe.
Esau Garner, the widow of Eric Garner, was hopeful after the New York City medical examiner ruled that Garner's death was a homicide on August 1st.
I met with the prosecutors, and I feel like I did the right thing by doing that, and I just want them to do the right thing and give me justice for my husband. And thank you. Thank you. That's all I'm going to say. Thank you.
Despite the fact that the incident was caught on tape and ruled a homicide, the grand jury decided not to indict Daniel Pantaleo, the white officer who killed Garner, who was black, by putting him in an illegal chokehold. Use of the chokehold has been prohibited by New York City Police Department policy since 1993. The video showing Garner's death also showed that police waited 7 minutes before giving Garner CPR. The man who taped Garner's death, Ramsey Orta, was subsequently arrested by Garner's co-workers on the force on weapons charges, creating a possible conflict of interest for the DA's office, which nevertheless took the case to the grand jury without seeking a special prosecutor. President Barack Obama and Attorney General Eric Holder each issued statements shortly after the grand jury's findings were made public.
As some of you may have heard, there was a decision that came out today by a grand jury not to indict police officers who had interacted with an individual named Eric Garner in New York City, all of which was caught on videotape and speaks to the larger issues that we've been talking about now for the last week, the last month, the last year, and sadly, for decades. And that is the concern on the part of too many minority communities that law enforcement is not working with them and dealing with them in a fair way. And there is going to be, I'm sure, additional statements by law enforcement. My tradition is not to remark on cases where there may still be an investigation. But I want everybody to understand that this week, in the wake of Ferguson, we initiated a task force whose job it is to come back to me with specific recommendations about how we strengthen the relationship between law enforcement and communities of color and minority communities that feel that bias is taking place, that we are going to take specific steps to improve the training and the work with state and local governments when it comes to policing in communities of color, that we are going to be scrupulous in investigating cases where we are concerned about the impartiality and accountability that's taking place. And as I said, when I met with folks both from Ferguson and law enforcement and clergy and civil rights activists, I said, this is an issue that we've been dealing with for too long, and it's time for us to make more progress than we've made. And I'm not interested in talk, I'm interested in action, and I am absolutely committed as President of the United States to making sure that we have a country in which everybody believes in the core principle that we are equal under the law. So I just got off the phone with my Attorney General Eric Holder. He will have more specific comments about the case in New York. But I want everybody to know here, as well as everybody who may be viewing my remarks here today, we are not going to let up until we see a strengthening of the trust and a strengthening of the accountability that exists between our communities and our law enforcement.
I want to provide an update regarding the case involving Eric Garner, a Staten Island resident who died tragically in July of this year. Since Mr. Garner's death, the United States Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York, the Civil Rights Division, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation have been monitoring the local case closely while allowing the local investigation led by the District Attorney's Office in Staten Island to proceed first. Earlier today, the grand jury declined to return an indictment in this case. Now that the local investigation has concluded, I'm here to announce that the Justice Department will proceed with a federal civil rights investigation into Mr. Garner's death. This afternoon, I spoke with the widow of Eric Garner to inform her and her family of our decision to investigate potential federal civil rights violations. I've also been in touch with President Obama as well as Mayor de Blasio regarding our decision. Our prosecutors will conduct an independent, thorough, fair, and expeditious investigation. In addition to performing our own investigative work, the department will conduct a complete review of the material gathered during the local investigation. Now, we've all seen the video of Mr. Garner's arrest. His death, of course, was a tragedy. All lives must be valued. All lives. Mr. Garner's death is one of several recent incidents across our great country that have tested the sense of trust that must exist between law enforcement and the communities they are charged to serve and to protect. This is not a New York issue, nor a Ferguson issue alone. Those who have protested peacefully across our great country following the grand jury's decision in Ferguson have made that very clear. As the brother of a retired police officer, I know in a very personal way about the bravery of the men and women in uniform who put their lives at risk every day to protect public safety. The vast majority of our law enforcement officers perform their duties honorably and are committed to respecting their fellow citizens' civil rights as they carry out their very challenging work. It is for their sake as well that we must seek to heal the breakdown in trust that we have seen. Earlier this week, I traveled to Atlanta to begin a series of interactions to begin this process, and officials around the country at every level of the United States Department of Justice will continue this vital ongoing work. As the Justice Department's independent investigations into the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner proceed, I will continue these conversations as we seek to restore trust, to rebuild understanding, and to foster cooperation between law enforcement and the communities they serve.
Bruce Dixon is the managing editor of BlackAgendaReport.com. We spoke with him by telephone Thursday. So, Bruce, we've got another no bill on another dead black person with another white cop being more or less exonerated by another very complex grand jury proceeding. You've seen a few of these cases, and as a matter of fact, today being the anniversary of the murder of Fred Hampton, you can go back at least that far looking at how the police never seem to be held accountable for these things.
Well, this is America, and that's essentially how the system works. If you're a cop, if you're acting under color of law and you've got a badge and you're on the public payroll, that's one of the things you get, is you get a license to kill. The police are, no matter what, you know, we might want to think about them as individuals, the police are the sharp edge of the state. And the state is an instrument of class and domination, and the state has to protect its own. And it does.
And, of course, in America, class means race, and so it becomes an instrument also of racial domination, which is, I mean, you can see the dead people and the exonerated cops almost color-coded here.
Almost, but, I mean, if you're a black cop, you get the same license that the white guys get.
Mm.
So, but yeah, you're essentially correct, yeah.
We've seen some cases up here, actually, where it's more like a learner's permit. There was a black cop who was wrestling with a guy who had been harassing somebody at a welfare office in White Plains, and he ended up getting shot by two white cops because they thought he was the perpetrator. They killed him, and they got exonerated.
Mm. Yeah, but the key thing was that the black cop was shot by another cop.
You're right. That,
you know,
yeah,
if
right.
the black cop had been shot by someone other than a cop,
right.
then that would have been different. But as long as the shooter is acting under color of law and has a badge, it's all good.
Mm.
And this thing about repurposing grand juries to avoid trials is not entirely a new thing. I know we saw it down here in Georgia a few years ago. Remember, I think 4 years ago, there was a prison strike here in Georgia. And in the aftermath of the prison strike, officials at several different state prisons retaliated savagely against prisoners, and they beat a couple of them into within an inch or two of their lives. And there was one guy who hung between life and death for about 2 weeks. And while he was in a coma, they shifted him back and forth between this medical facility, hundreds of miles to that one. And the grand jury in one of the counties, it escapes me which one, the prosecutor was, there was public pressure on him to charge these correctional officials, and for some reason the prosecutor thought that they couldn't just do it themselves. So what they did is they took it to a grand jury, and they had to do three passes at the grand jury before they could get an indictment. Mm. But the first two times, the grand juries just refused to indict, but then again, the grand jury is entirely the creature of the prosecutor.
Right. That's one of the observations that I've heard made, that the old ham sandwich canard apparently only works if the pork is dead. if it's alive, then they have a problem with the indictment. The grand jury process itself, as a means of an indictment, people have a very fuzzy understanding of it, to the extent they have an understanding. First of all, in about half the states in the United States, there is no grand jury, and in almost every state, the norm is the prosecutor files charges, and then if the defense calls for it, there's a hearing on the charges where the level of probable cause has to be met after a hearing. But the use of a grand jury in order to charge someone is certainly not mandatory, and the norm for a grand jury historically has been that you bring in, say, a detective who says, I have an affidavit from a confidential informant or from a witness that says this happened, this happened, this happened. Sometimes the grand jury wants to see the witness and talk with them, but generally that's sufficient to reach probable cause. And now what they do is they bring in all of the evidence, especially including the exculpatory evidence, and present that to a grand jury as if they're having a trial, but there's only one side represented.
Well, you're absolutely right. Grand juries traditionally have been the equivalent of preliminary hearings at which defendants and their lawyers don't necessarily get to present any evidence. Grand juries are supposed to establish whether the basic facts in the case warrant somebody being charged and the offense going to trial. What you've had here is you've had a repurposing of the grand jury to serve as a kind of substitute trial in which there's no cross examinations and the prosecutors get to call all the witnesses, and in many cases, the proceedings get to be secret, and of course, most importantly of all, to which there's no appeal.
Right, that's right. That's
you know, so this is just a this grand jury thing was for the most part a foregone conclusion, both in the Missouri case and in the New York City case.
So going back to today being the anniversary of Fred Hampton's murder, Fred Hampton, of course, became a target of the police because he was a very successful organizer in Chicago for the Black Panther Party. And the Black Panther Party was essentially a response to police brutality upon the black community. People were organizing basically for purposes of self-defense within the law, generally. Fred Hampton was...
Well, I would say it was broader than that. The purpose of the Black Panther Party, I mean, that was one of the stands of the Black Panther Party,
right,
is that we had the absolute human right to self-defense. Right. True.
Right.
But the Black Panther Party was... I would characterize the Black Panther Party as a response to the political dilemma that Black America found itself in when the civil rights movement and had succeeded as far as it was going to succeed.
Right.
And then the question is, so what are you going to do? You got a Voting Rights Act that they're going to start enforcing soon, you know, but the approaches of the civil rights movement are not working in the North. They don't answer the problems of the urban ghettos in Chicago and Detroit and everywhere else. It's an answer to legal Jim Crow, but not much else.
Right.
And so Black America faced a political dilemma. And it was also a time when there was an imperial war going on. And most importantly, the imperial war was being fueled by a draft. So the army, the drafty army, combat units of the drafty army in the Vietnam era were majority black and brown, which is a different world from today. And that's the political situation that gave rise to the Black Panther Party. But yeah, today is the 45th anniversary of the death of Chairman Fred Hampton.
Right.
And all of us who knew him and worked with him were privileged to know him and work with him. And many who've come into the struggle in the years after do set aside, you know, some time today to remember him. And Fred always said that if you're not going to do something revolutionary, if you're not going to be working for the people, not to bother to remember him. So we feel like we have to work hard to be worthy of his memory.
Mm. Yeah, there was much more to the Black Panther Party than just the self-defense component, obviously. There was a political program, a 10-point political program that dealt with empowerment of the community, basically. And it was also, as a political response, an attempt to, you know, you have the right to vote, but you have no power base outside of your voting and no organization for even wielding that. And this was an attempt to bring power back to the community level so it could be wielded in the political process.
But you are perfectly right, Don, to talk about self-defense here.
Right.
And that is definitely a dimension of our humanity and of the struggle that is being consciously and deliberately short-sighted and left out nowadays. You know, part of the notion that black faces in high places are going to get us out of all this, you know, has been the surrender. And there's really no other word for it, but the abject surrender to state violence that we've been encouraged to embrace, and we don't even talk about our right to self-defense and the implications of that right. And that really, really does need to be part of the conversation. Never mind the fact that self-defense against the state is always going to be illegal.
Right. Yeah, I mean, what we're talking about here is armed violence by the state against people. And self-defense can include some very clever nonviolent organizing, but can't be limited to that. In some cases, the only response
is
an armed response.
Well, even the nonviolent organizing, is illegal.
Right.
I mean, the definitions that law enforcement organizations and have of terrorism is anything illegal.
Right.
Anything illegal that's designed to alter and any illegal act that's designed to alter an economic or a political fact,
right.
Excluding the illegal acts of corporations, of course.
Right. Yes, of course.
You know, when we're, you
right.
know, but illegal acts of persons,
right.
You know, that are not about tax evasion, and you know, are terrorism.
Right.
So by those definitions, people blocking traffic are terrorists, and let's not fool ourselves. In the days immediately before the grand jury decision in Ferguson, the Obama administration sent an extra 100 FBI personnel to Ferguson, Missouri.
That's right.
Now, do you think they were there to spy on the cops? Or do you think they were there to gather information on and interfere in the operations of citizens who had legitimate dissents? You know, to our country's policies of police immunity and police impunity. Well, the answer is clear. They were sent there to spy on citizens, not to restrain the police.
Right.
And this is the same Obama administration that spent tons of police resources and counterintelligence resources and NSA resources and what have you to break up the Occupy movement.
Right. Yeah, they coordinated a national police response, as a matter of fact.
Yes, and they're the same Obama administration that said nothing when local authorities in New Jersey doubled the bounty on the head of Assata Shakur from $1 million to $2 million.
Right.
And make no mistake about it, he could have had plenty to say about this because Assata Shakur is a political refugee in Cuba.
Yeah.
So this has international implications. And the Obama administration had every right to say something about it if they disagreed with it.
Right. That's right.
So, you know, this is the political reality we have right now is we've got a black attorney general and a black president and a situation where self-defense against police violence seems to be off the table.
You know... The black president and black attorney general who, a week and change after Ferguson, come up with cameras on police as a remedy, and then almost, to mock it, we have the Garner case, which was captured entirely on video and still didn't result in an indictment.
This thing of police body cameras, like you said, it's not only... didn't prevent the deaths of Eric Garner, didn't prevent the death of that 12-year-old in Cleveland.
That's right.
Didn't prevent the death of John Crawford in Ohio. It's going to open up big terrain for lots of horrible abuses.
And also did not result in the case of Garner in an indictment. They had the entire event there with a certification from the medical examiner that the death was a homicide, with an audio recording of the victim saying that he couldn't breathe while you could see the chokehold being applied, and the medical examiner saying that asphyxiation was the primary cause of death, and the fact that the chokehold is, against policy of NYPD, so, and they couldn't even get a criminally negligent homicide indictment out of it. So, I don't see the value that way either. Let me go to the Occupy thing for a moment, because you mentioned that. Back in the late 60s and early 70s, as the civil rights movement moved from, or as the black liberation struggle moved from the civil rights movement into empowerment, into black power, into attempts to actually defend the community and develop the community. There was also the opposition to the Vietnam War among the white middle-class youth in particular, based on the draft. And, you know, trying to tie those two things together got Martin Luther King killed almost immediately. And nevertheless, objective conditions had those two things developing together. And that was dissipated by the legislation that withdrew the draft, basically. The white kids went back to school and went into their careers, and their use as allies, you know, they were gone. Now the Occupy phenomenon is more a case of the impoverishment of the middle class. These kids that are protesting now come out of college with $100,000 worth of debt and no job available. And that's not something that can be legislated away. That's a condition that's actually going to intensify. What do you think are the prospects going forward for a coalition? Because you've seen a lot of Occupy kids involved in the protests now in Ferguson and elsewhere.
Well, there are definite. I mean, Occupy was only 2 years ago. So, you know, there's definitely any number of people who were involved in Occupy and cut their teeth on it or had been involved in different political things before and were part of that, are still active and still around and took part in mobilizations and teach-ins and whatnot on Ferguson. And so Occupy might not be with us any longer, but it's left its mark, just like, you know, previous efforts are. And definitely there will be coalitions and formations, but nobody can predict what they're going to look like.
Hmm. And then going forward, if you could call the shots, what kind of advice would you be giving to people in the streets right now about what they need to be working on to move this forward?
Well, the only piece of advice that I would give would be, as an organizer, if you assemble your crowd via social media, by the radio, or by you know, the magic of some kinds of electronic or cybernetic communications, Facebook, Twitter, what have you, be sure that you get the phone numbers and the direct phone numbers and the email addresses and the names of as many of your co-participants in these efforts as you can. Do not be exclusively dependent on social media to reach them, because right now you can still reach these people with Twitter and Facebook. But the nature of social media, corporate social media, is that if we are not standing by our Facebook feeds, if we are not monitoring our Twitter feeds today, and the call goes out today, we'll miss it. Mm. And also, Facebook and Twitter and Tumblr and such do not give you the direct information to contact people outside of them. Think about the Million Man March in 1995. The organizers of the Million Man March remembered to pass the hat and collect money, but you know what they forgot to do? They forgot to circulate an attendance list. They could have came away from the Million Man March with a Million Man mailing list and a Million Man phone contact list. Think what a powerful tool that would have been. So wherever you get together in your town and in your neighborhood around this Ferguson verdict, this Garner verdict, and the next 10 or 20 atrocities, be sure you get the direct names, the direct phone numbers, and the direct email addresses of as many of your co-participants as you can, so that you can contact them independently outside of social media.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.